Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening this morning. This hour, what if America had more than 50 states? And what if some of our largest states were broken up? That's the argument in a New York Times op-ed that caught my eye. Noah Millman, who writes about politics at The Week, imagines a country where citizens in huge states like California and Texas have more representation because they're smaller, and where more political camaraderie could be observed. Mr. Millman writes, carving up Texas would open up opportunities for Democrats, but could also lower the temperature on the possibility of the state's flipping blue by giving residents of Lubbock and Midland an escape route to a safely red republic. So as we contemplate the logistical and political implications of this with our guests, I'd like to hear from you. Do you see some compelling reasons for adding more states when it comes to fairer representation and more equality among the states? Are we opening a Pandora's box and messing with a precedent that has been in place since the last states were added in 1959? So listen as our conversation develops about this idea of fairer representation, more equality among the states, or is this really going to a place that we don't need to go and that contains a lot of complications? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet in at Carrie NPR. Eric McDaniel is with us, an associate professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. And with us from Austin, and Professor McDaniel, welcome. It's good to have you on the show, particularly because you're from Texas. So I'm glad to have you on today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Richard Kreitner is with us, a writer for The Nation. In 2020, he published Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. And with us from Brooklyn, and Richard Kreitner, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Professor McDaniel, I want to come back to you since you're in Texas, because I think many of us are acquainted with these arguments for making Washington, D.C. a state or making Puerto Rico a state. This is a case for dividing up a state like yours that is what has a large economy, that has a huge number of people. And this is what Noah Millman writes about that. America needs new states, not only to provide representation for those living in territories, but also more urgently to provide adequate representation to those who have congressional representation, but whose votes perversely carry less weight because of the state's size. He's talking about how we apportion representation to Congress, isn't he?
Yes. There have been calls for expanding the House of Representatives from 435 to maybe 500 or so, because the size of the districts now, in population size, is so much larger than originally imagined. And so putting a cap of 435 actually cuts down representation drastically.
Yeah, and I think I just want our listeners to understand the math of that. Large districts, the same number of representatives in Congress, your power gets diluted, yes?
Very much so. And in the Senate, so where we think of the House as providing the power to the big states, the Senate provides the power to the smaller states. And there is this belief that with people kind of moving to certain states and other states getting smaller, that the Senate really is not representative of the public. And so if you add more states, it means you would add more senators, and so the Senate would be a better reflection of the people in general.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Kreitner, it appears that because there are a larger number of small states, they have a kind of supermajority over the big states because there are more small states. Do you buy that argument? What do you make of it?
That is correct. I mean, this is one of the oldest arguments in American history, going back to before even there was a United States, you know, when the colonies got together in the Continental Congress in 1774, 1775, to consider how to register a protest with the crown. They immediately started debating this issue about whether each colony would have one vote or whether they would have different numbers of votes by proportion of population. And it's always been this kind of explosive question, and that arose again during the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and nearly led to the end of that convention and really the end of the Union. And they, you know, they got through a compromise, basically, which saved the convention and the Union, which gave, you know, different houses of Congress different ways of apportioning population, as Professor McDaniel just said. You know, the House is supposed to be by population and the Senate, of course, by states. But we have serious legitimacy problems in each chamber, because in the House, the number of congressional districts and representatives has not been increased in over a century. And at this point, each representative is serving, I think, approximately 30 times more people than when the country was founded, which really means that each of us, just in the House, which is supposed to be the more representative chamber, is, you know, each of us is 1/30th as powerful as a citizen was in 1790, you know, setting aside the ways in which the electorate itself has been, you know, expanded. And then in the Senate, the difference in population between California, the largest state, and Wyoming, the smallest or least populous state, is now 1/67th. So for every citizen of Wyoming has approximately 67 times the power of a citizen of California, which is way out of line with what it was at the founding, which is about 1/13 was the ratio. So we have serious problems here. And I welcome the suggestion to break up the largest states as, you know, an interesting proposal, definitely outside the box. And, you know, I'm all for that. I'm not sure it is the exact solution that we really need, though.
So we'll talk about some of the other optional solutions here. Let me grab a call from Josh in Duluth. Hi, Josh. What do you think of this idea? What comes to mind?
Hi. What came to mind? Thank you for taking my call, by the way. I absolutely love listening to you guys.
Thanks.
What came to mind for me was we have, you know, Guam and Puerto Rico who are not represented right now. And our country was founded on not being taxed without being represented. And as the Your guest just said, the representation is already out of whack, and we have populations that legitimately don't have any real representation in our government. And I just don't understand how this is, you know, a conversation that is winnable to keep them not states. Because we're literally doing to them what the Crown did to us back when we wanted our own freedom.
Richard, what do you think of that argument?
I couldn't agree more. I think that is a higher priority, more pressing. I would add Washington, D.C., of course. You know, I think they say taxation without representation right there on the license plates. And I think they have, as the caller says, a totally, you know, tight argument for being admitted to the union as states.
Professor McDaniel, one of the interesting things here is if we think about a state like Texas, again, with its population, or California, with its wealth and population and clout. You know, I think we often think of those states as having kind of an outsized influence in politics. But I'm looking at the way the power is being played out in the Senate right now. And you've got Joe Manchin, a senator from a very small state of West Virginia, who is wielding his power and his votes, right, over the interests and beliefs of the senators from California or New York or Texas. And some of them are all from the same party. I mean, this just shows how the system that we have right now is not really representative of, right, that the power and the influence that a large state perhaps should have. What does that example tell you about the way things are set up now?
So a lot of it is thinking about majority rule, minority rights. And so what the smaller states would argue is, like, no, we're protecting ourselves to make sure the larger states don't run roughshod over us. But then a lot of people would argue, like, well, you're getting in the way of progress. You're stopping important things from being done. And, you know, it's important to know that there are certain states have particular interests that they want to protect. And And while it may help them in their self-interest, it hurts the group. And this is kind of the argument being given towards Senator Manchin, but also West Virginia, and it's want to preserve coal, that you have these smaller states who are doing things that are bad for that are good for them, but could be very bad for the group. And this becomes really a classic tug of war in, you know, the idea of majority rule, minority rights. When does the majority basically get to say, no, we're going to do this no matter what you say? And when does the minority get to speak up? And it's a balancing act. And, you know, it's very difficult. I mean, look at right now with Texas, with the Democrats leaving the state. This is an example of majority rule versus minority rights, and a minority group is basically holding the legislature hostage because they don't want to deal. They don't want passage on this Voting Rights Act and some other things that they think are highly controversial and highly problematic.
Richard, Professor McDaniel just said it's a balancing act. And there has been a debate that seems to have intensified, I guess, as we've become more polarized just in the last at least decade, that we are out of balance. Would you argue that?
I would definitely argue that. You know, you look at the numbers, but I blame really our institutions and ultimately the Constitution, I think, which has passed down to us certain structures and institutions that are making things a lot worse rather than making them better. You know, for instance, the Electoral College, which twice in the last, you know, 20 years and nearly three times, if a couple votes have gone differently in November, has overridden the democratic results of a presidential election and given the presidency to somebody who won fewer votes, which to me is unconscionable, you know, in the 21st century and totally incompatible with our ideas of democracy. So there's an instance where something is completely out of balance, and it's an old, you know, rather rickety and antiquated constitution that we're working with, which is really, you know, not up to the task of the present day. You know, you mentioned Senator Manchin from West Virginia not wanting to abolish the filibuster, and that, you know, getting in the way of, you know, extremely pressing measures on climate change, on health care, you know, existential matters for lots of people, and ultimately for all of us with regard to climate change. The numbers, I need to check them again, but I'm pretty sure it's something like senators representing about 11% of the American population now have enough votes in the Senate to block legislation because of the filibuster. And that is, but, you know, you can't govern a country that way.
What you were saying, though, about electoral politics, isn't that more the problem of the Electoral College? If there was reform in the way the Electoral College works, wouldn't we resolve some of the issues that you're describing?
Perhaps with regards to the presidential race, I mean, the only way I see to reform the Electoral College would be to abolish it entirely. But that would leave the Senate, you know, that would leave all, you know, the fact that this totally unrepresentative chamber has a veto on all legislation, all judicial appointments, cabinet appointments, treaties, and you know, a lot of the inequity of the Electoral College is based in the fact that it's based on the total representation that each state enjoys in the national legislature in both houses, and the Senate totally distorts that. That's not the worst possible thing about the Electoral College, but it leads to these undemocratic results. So I guess what I'm getting at is, to me, the problem is not so much the different sizes of the states, so that breaking them up would be the solution to the problem. The problem is equal representation in the Senate. So you would need to either abolish the Senate, which would be very difficult, or my preferred solution, I'd be interested in Professor McDaniel's thoughts and your callers, would be to basically defang it or take away its veto over national legislation. So it would be more like a House of Lords kind of honorary body, you know, where we can put our celebrities. Celebrities are running for the Senate anyway, so we might as well, you know, appoint them to the Senate and not let them have any actual, you know, ability to block important legislation.
I mean, how would that – wouldn't the U.S. Senate have to vote on its own, basically – defanged, as you describe. I can't even imagine that ever getting through Congress.
Well, it wouldn't have to, because the constitutional amendment process doesn't require congressional approval for precisely this reason.
See.
You know, you can have a convention of the states where you propose, you know, articles such as this or amendments like this that then go to the states for ratification. I mean, it's an extremely unwieldy process. It's never been tried before, controversial, could go in lots of different directions. But, you know, the alternative is not doing anything about climate change, which is, as we're seeing on every continent right now, a totally existential issue.
Professor McDaniel, what do you think? Does the urgency of the challenges that confront the country argue for something that sounds pretty extreme?
Yeah, I mean, whenever a crisis comes about, people are willing to take extreme action. And one thing that's very important is that the House does change in regards to population shifts. So the number of representatives each state has changes every 10 years in the House. But in the Senate, it stays the same. And so I could see, and so because of that, the Senate is not reacting to any demographic changes whatsoever, and it keeps it out of place. And so maybe, you know, defanging the Senate and giving more power to the House is the way to go. I'm not sure if I fully agree with that, but I do think it is a solution we should talk about.
It's a conversation this morning about how to bring better and more representation of a changing America to Washington, to the chambers that represent us. And Noah Millman wrote an interesting op-ed in the Times that caught my eye. And so this is one of the arguments for addressing the problem here. He is basically saying, hey, break up some of these larger states like California, Texas, and New York. Allow them to, or have the citizens vote on creating smaller states, and then they get more direct representation because they don't have the small two senators going to Washington for these burgeoning populations. And so we're talking with our guests this morning, Eric McDaniel from the University of Texas at Austin, and Richard Kreitner, who has been thinking and writing about this for a while. He writes for The Nation. About some of the solutions to address this. I want to hear from you this morning. Do you see some compelling reasons for adding more states, defanging, as Richard Kreitner describes it, of the Senate to bring in fairer representation and more equality among the states and of that representation? Are we really just opening a Pandora's box in messing with precedents that have been in place for a long time, including the same number of states since 1959? What do you think of some of the arguments you're listening to? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Bill in Bloomington. Hi, Bill. Sounds like you've been giving some thought to this. What do you think?
Well, I've been thinking about it for many years, and as Stephen Colbert often says, do we need two Dakotas? I mean, there are many solutions, but the main problem in the U.S. is that we were the first real democracy in the world, and the design we made is so anachronistic and unwieldy that we no longer have a real democracy. The question is not what state are you from anymore, but the question is how do people get what they need and want? And we can't get what we need and want because we don't really have a real democracy. I have been all over the world, and of the democracies, we're one of the least democratic. And shortly, the Senate, a few states, a few very small minority of the population will control the Senate. So I would start out by saying we do need a new constitution. Now, there are problems with writing one, mainly because the people who control the U.S. would probably control that convention. And so we still might not end up with real democracy.
Okay, so writing a new constitution, is that something else, Bill, that you wanted to add on top of that? Or can I take that back to the guests?
I just want to get clear that what the gentleman you brought in, that's what they're saying. They're suggesting things that would change the basic structure of the federal government.
Okay.
And a major piece of that would be, he says, defang the Senate. Well, no, very few countries have such things. We don't really need a Senate.
So let me do this. Bill, thank you for that. We have a number of people waiting, so I want to get to them as well. Professor McDaniel, is Bill right when he says the way our representative system works today is not just frustrating and not just, you know, basically sideline some of the most challenging issues, but it is really endangering the the principle of democracy?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are get wary of changing the Constitution. And I actually have a colleague, Zachary Elkins, who studied constitutions and the endurance of constitutions. And he looks at how long they last, things like that. And interestingly enough, Thomas Jefferson actually argued that you should rewrite the Constitution about every 20 years. And what he finds is that most constitutions last about 19 to 20 years. So Thomas Jefferson was correct in that. And the fact that the U.S. has not changed it and changed it in more than 200 years means that it's going to be out of place. Now, we've made certain amendments, you know, to expand voting rights, but we may need to go back to the drawing board. Okay, some of these original arrangements we had actually are not effective. They may have been effective then, but they're not effective now. And again, a lot of people might be wary of this, but Jefferson made it clear, you know, the dead should not govern the living. And I think what the caller was pointing out is that this is what's going on right now, and that, you know, a call for change is needed.
Wow. Richard, I mean, at first blush, that sounds pretty radical.
Well, I completely agree with it. I've been writing, you know, arguing for a new constitutional convention, you know, from sort of a left perspective, welcoming the invitation, because that, you know, that kind of call has been more popular on the right in recent years. And I wrote an essay for The Nation about 4 or 5 years ago saying that the left should accept that invitation to bring all of these, you know, unresolved questions to a kind of national dialogue, a constitutional convention to sort them out. I think that's absolutely right. I'm glad Professor McDaniel mentioned the Jefferson quote. The other thing to remember is that far more important to the founders and to the framers of the Constitution than democracy, which they actually disliked, and, you know, the hatred of it was really the one thing that they all had in common when they met in Philadelphia. Far more important than democracy to them was self-government, the idea of devising your own institutions, and that each generation, you know, had the not only the right but the responsibility to come up with a form of government that suited their tastes and their needs. And it seems to me that our kind of reflexive fear of a constitutional convention, certainly I share Bill's concern that, you know, entrenched economic interests and political interests would dominate the convention just as they do American politics today. I would hope that the process of ratifying any new amendments or constitution that such a gathering came up with would, you know, be a genuinely popular kind of plebiscite, and we could vote it down if we were displeased. But it seems to me that if we're scared to take our destiny into our own hands, to put it melodramatically, then we don't really believe in self-government anymore. And if that's the case, you know, we've got bigger problems than even I thought.
Call from William in Mankato. Hi, William. Thanks so much for waiting. Appreciate that. What are you thinking about?
I think that we need fewer big states, not more small states. Simply take the case of last January 6th. If Washington, D.C. was part of Maryland, the governor would have called out the National Guard, and we wouldn't have the trouble we have now.
So let me be clear on what you're saying. So to break up like California into three smaller states, and by the way, we're going to talk about the referendum failed in California.
California would be added to Nevada and Arizona.
Oh, so make bigger states.
Bigger states. 13 states maximum.
And the purpose for that is what?
Existing. What?
The purpose for that is what?
Well, to make it equal. If every state had 40 million people, it would be equal.
Huh. Professor McDaniel, what do you think? I don't know that that solves the problem that we're talking about this morning, but what do you think?
So that may... but the interesting thing about D.C. is that D.C. used to be a part of Maryland. And some people have talked about just adding this, having the state of Maryland absorb D.C., and that's how D.C. would get its representation. But as far as basically saying, look, let's have 13 states, very extremely large states, uh-huh. One of the problems you might have with that is one of the reasons why we have 50 states and we have federalism is to allow for a bunch of different cultures to kind of establish and have each state have its own political culture. And if you make them into 13 large states, probably expect for intense fights in all these states to establish what their culture is. Yeah. And this may create So while it may help at the federal level, I think at the state level, it will cause all kinds of chaos. And I think one of the things about that article that you mentioned an article, is that it talked about this relationship between cities and states.
Ah,
and that by
yes.
breaking them up into smaller states, the cities would have more power to make decisions and not have the states encroach upon it. And so I'm thinking, you know, if you absorb California into, you know, all those states, then all of a sudden people in California start dictating things to people in Nevada, and that may, and that's not going to go well because they're living two different lives.
Okay, so I'm really glad you touched on this, because this is something that is debated often up here in the upper Midwest, where we have a lot of rural territory, and then, you know, cities that kind of dominate the politics of the state. Richard, I don't see a solution like that really solving the truth, and we experience this here, of the rural-urban divide. I mean, the citizens of rural Minnesota and rural Wisconsin and rural Iowa often feel misrepresented by the issues that are most present, you know, under one governor or one state legislature. This I think this is a real issue in many states, and I wonder if anything that we're talking about here addresses that.
I think it's a great question. I don't really have a great solution for that. I do think that the political divide in our country is certainly much more of a rural-urban divide than a blue state, red state. You know,
right.
I think that, you know, where I am in Brooklyn has a lot more in common with Minneapolis, St. Paul than it does with, you know, places in upstate New York. And I don't really have a good, you know, constitutional framework for taking that into account. I think at some point, you know, the tensions are indeed, you know, minority power and minority rights. At some point, you either believe in democracy, one man, one vote, one person, one vote, or you don't. So if we keep seeing a greater wave of urbanization in our country, I think you're going to have a really hard time backing either existing or introducing new constitutional measures that disempower cities in favor of rural areas, because the discrepancy is going to grow too large. So I don't really have a great solution to that question, but I think it's an important dynamic to keep in mind.
I want to grab a question here from Connie before we go to news. Hi, Connie. Glad you called in. Sounded like you had a question. What do you want to know?
I do, and it's actually related to what we were just discussing, because I've talked about this for a while, and I think one of the things originally the framers wanted was to protect the interests of the different states, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what if we added to the Senate with regional representation, so that there was a, you know, the Pacific Northwest or the mountain ranges or the breadbasket, you know, the heartland, so that those things could be represented and we could think more systemically about our representation instead of just the borders of the states.
So some of these senators wouldn't represent their states. They would be kind of senators at large from areas, like economic areas of
exactly.
the country. Is that how? Okay. Let's get a look at the latest news. Let Eric McDaniel and Richard Kreitner dwell on that a little bit. And I love some of the questions and solutions you're proposing here. This is great. Call in this morning and talk about whether you see some compelling reasons for adding more states, for adding more representatives in Congress, for a new constitutional convention, as has been discussed. Would that resolve, would it at least address some of the most pressing issues confronting America and this idea that many, many Americans don't feel represented in Washington or even in their state legislatures? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet in at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. To Phil Picardin now with the latest. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Carrie. The Biden administration has transferred a detainee out of the Guantanamo Bay detention facility for the first time in a major shift in policy from the Trump presidency. A Moroccan man was sent back home today, years after he was recommended for discharge. The Pentagon says a review determined the man's detention was no longer necessary to protect U.S. national security. 39 prisoners remain at Guantanamo. A Florida man who entered the Senate chamber carrying a Trump campaign flag on January 6th is scheduled to become the first rioter at the U.S. Capitol that day, sentenced for a felony. A hearing today in Washington will help set benchmark for punishment in similar cases. Prosecutors want the man to serve 18 months behind bars. An alternate on the U.S. women's gymnastics team has tested positive for COVID-19 in an Olympic training camp in Japan. USA Gymnastics says another alternate was placed into isolation because of contact tracing. USA Gymnastics says the athletes moved to separate lodging and accommodations and a separate training facility. Two Minnesota women are on the team, but they are not alternates. An investigation by a global media consortium alleges military-grade malware from Israel-based NSO Group is being used to spy on journalists, human rights activists, and political dissidents. NSO Group is the world's most infamous hacker-for-hire outfit. The consortium of 17 news organizations says it identified more than 1,000 individuals in 50 countries allegedly selected by NSO clients for potential surveillance. They include about 200 journalists. And erratic winds and lightning have added to the dangers for crews battling the nation's largest wildfire in Parched, Oregon. The Bootleg Fire, now just north of the California border, is about 25% contained. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 9:37.
More than 35 million families are now getting monthly cash payments thanks to a child tax credit.
Yes, it is a big deal.
This expanded program will help lift many out of poverty, but it could also bring some unexpected tax bills next year.
Once people start expecting it, no politician is going to want to pull it back.
Can this temporary fix solve a long-term problem? Next time on 1A.
1A starts at 10 a.m. here on NPR News.
I'm Angela Davis. At 11, NPR senior economics contributor Chris Farrell talks to financial experts and answers your questions about navigating the consumer economy, like what's up with the current spike in prices, at 11.
On the podcast right now, The Smelly Science of Sweat. Did you catch that show on Friday? Boy, I learned a lot. And you had some great observations and calls. So if you missed it, you can find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., the richest of the rich in America get a pretty sweet deal from the IRS. Should average Americans care about that? We talk about it tomorrow at 9.
Programming supported by the Minnesota Historical Society. Create your own historic adventure at MNHS historic sites and museums throughout Minnesota this summer. Discover significant places and people that helped shape our state. Tickets at mnhs.org.
Support comes from Comcast Business, helping with whatever the day brings. They'll handle it with gig speeds and cybersecurity solutions. Every day in business is a big day. Comcast Business will help prepare for what's next. Business.comcast.com, powering possibilities.
Back to the conversation now with Eric McDaniel, an associate professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, and Richard Kreitner, writer for The Nation and the author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. And we will talk about secession because there is a fascinating new poll out for brightlinewatch.org. So we'll talk about that. But Professor McDaniel, to what Connie suggested, which is a Senate that includes regional senators who represent what the economic and demographic interests of those regions. What do you think about the idea of that?
I think it's kind of interesting, but if you think of the committee setup, that's what the committees are supposed to do. And bringing them in for a specific concern, the problem is with some of these states, there's so many different things going on. So say like California, you have certain financial interests, but you also have agricultural interests. And so I guess the problem is saying that somebody represents one thing in that area. These areas have become so complicated with so many different industries and production going on that I don't think anybody could say, you know, I speak for the heartland by just talking about this one thing when there are so many things going on in the heartland.
You know, Professor, there seemed like there was some interest a while back in, you know, state compacts where the Great Lakes states would get together because there were a number of issues that, you know, that they shared. And that seems to kind of rise and fall as, you know, as the politics goes on. But it never really seems to take hold with some kind of cohesion. And maybe it's because, you know, each state has such different, so many different interests that they're, you know, that they just don't share enough commonality. I don't know. You know, with a Wisconsin, with the Dakotas, maybe the politics are too polarized. Why do you think that doesn't take hold?
Well, one of the first things we have to remember is that states are in competition with each other. And
True. It's
one of the things that we think of them as being, well, they kind of look alike. Because they look alike, they're all fighting over the same resources. So that, I think that's part of it. And, you know, when we see states getting these compacts, you might get a little bit nervous, Christophe, because that might lead to what we'll talk about later on, a secession. It's like, well, right. You know, we all kind of think the same, so we should just break off and be our own. So there is some concern about that. But I do think that the competition between the states and then also just the various dynamics, in political cultures can break these things up very mm-hmm. easily.
So, Richard, let's talk about secession. I'm sure this new poll that came out from BrightlineWatch.org that found that large numbers of Americans would be willing to secede, particularly in the South, to secede from the U.S. and join a union of states in their region. That's probably not news to you. What should we understand about what Americans are saying and the real practicality of that?
Sure. I mean, you know, the poll was very careful to say that it may be the I think they put it very diplomatically, the unconsidered opinion of some of the respondents who might yeah. say to a pollster on the phone that they're willing to support secession, but would be very unlikely to, you know, lift a musket in defense of their new nation, much less even to see their taxes go up or something. So I think we do have to take it with a grain of salt. That said, unmistakably, support for secession, discussion of secession, and I would argue even the real prospects of some kind of fracturing have unmistakably gone up over the last 10 to 15 years. You know, after every presidential election, 2004, 2008, 2012, 16, and 2020, discussion of secession, particularly, of course, among the losers of that presidential contest, has gotten louder and louder. You know, after 2008, you had the Texas Governor Rick Perry saying it would be a shame to leave this union, but if we have to, we will. That was in the early days of the Tea Party. After 2012, there were petitions coming into the White House website from every state calling for secession, mostly from Republicans, of course. After 2016, there was a lot of talk in California about this. And after 2020, there's been, somebody for the first time in the Texas legislature, you know, introduced a bill calling for a referendum for Texas to leave the union. There are all kinds of practical obstacles here, which we can and should talk about. But it's notable, I think, that this is becoming talked about more and more. And I just want to go back to the regional question a little bit, because
sure.
I talk about this in my book quite a lot. It's kind of the great road not taken in American history, the idea of separate regional unions rather than one large continental one is an idea that also has existed since before the United States was around and has been proposed periodically as a way out of some kind of intractable national dispute. It was a peace plan that was introduced on the eve of the Civil War to give each of what was then they considered four regions a veto power basically over important national legislation and even presidential elections. Unless a presidential candidate could win support from all four regions, which of course was a test that Abraham Lincoln was going to fail, they could not become president. So this has always been kind of the great alternative. And I think it's, you know, what struck me a year ago, when the first wave of coronavirus hit, was that many governors kind of rallied
Absolutely.
Together and banded
right.
together in these subnational regional compacts as a way to replace essentially a federal government that had abdicated its responsibility to handle this pandemic and the economic lockdowns that were required to suppress its spread. And it seems to me that in a state of emergency, such as climate change is going to bring more and more of, that we're probably going to see more and more resorting to that kind of measure. And at some point, it might become, a more permanent fixture of our politics.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought up the coronavirus, because I was thinking about that as I was preparing for the show. Here's what happened, though, in our state, in Minnesota. You know, the governor was pursuing some policies that he decided were best for the people of Minnesota. States around us were doing very different things. I'm sure you've read what was happening in the Dakotas, for instance, and in Iowa. So the policies that the Governor Walz in Minnesota was pursuing in the midst of this pandemic and this crisis were in some ways being undermined by what the governors, around us were doing. And there was very little cohesion in this, in this part of the country. I hear you on some states, you're right, work together. Here was an example of states bordering neighboring states working against each other. It really depends on the crisis.
Say Wisconsin and Illinois, probably, I would think, other neighboring states. It might just be that the Dakotas and Minnesota would end up in different regional configurations.
Call now from Aaron in St. Paul. Hi, Aaron. Thanks so much for waiting. What do you want to talk about?
So I had heard several years ago that when Texas became a state, there was a provision that it could split into up to 5 states without federal processes. And I'm wondering if that's true and how that plays out in this conversation.
You're talking about at the formation of the state of Texas.
Yes.
At the beginning. Professor McDaniel, is that true?
Yes, it is. And the problem is a lot of people in the state of Texas think that this provision allows them to secede. And it's like, no, it allows you to break up into 5 states. And the thing about secession is, the Supreme Court has basically ruled that the Civil War showed that you cannot secede. But there has been an argument in Texas to split Texas up into five states. And, this might be a way for Democrats to get some more power, but also this is a huge state with a bunch of different cultures. So my wife is from Beaumont, which is southeast Texas, and I'll say she's from East Texas. No. I'm from southeast Texas. It's very clear that what's going on in Amarillo is different what's going on in Beaumont, what's going on in El Paso, what's going on in Brownsville, what's going on in Austin. Like, you have all these different regions. And so you have a state that's kind of, because it's so large, it has so many different cultures within it. And so there is that argument for, because it was so large, we could break up into 5 different states. But some people just say, oh, no, we can secede. It's like, no, you can't secede. You can break up into 5 states. And so you'd still be part of the union, but you'd be, instead of one state, you'd be 5.
I mean, Professor, also, since we, yeah, go ahead, Richard.
Oh, I'm sorry to jump in. Just, interesting side fact about that provision that a lot of people are not aware of is that it had everything to do with slavery at the time, which is that Democrats in Congress, like a guy named Thomas Hart Benton, for instance, refused to vote for Texas's admission to the Union because they knew that it was going to enter the Union as a slave state. And they wanted a provision that would allow less, slave-dependent parts of the state to separate and become their own free states, which is a provision that, pro-slavery forces in Congress and in Texas had no intention whatsoever of ever actually allowing to be triggered. It was just kind of a salve to the conscience of these anti-slavery Democrats in Congress.
Craig says on Twitter, we need a solution that gives more equal representation for people regardless of where they live, not favoring urban or rural voters. And states ought to be big enough that they're as near self-sufficient as possible. To Nolan in Stillwater. Hi, Nolan. Thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Well, the conversation about regional governments has always been top of mind for me. I don't think you reach consensus by creating a larger federal government based upon more states. The only real solution is to create a federal government that's more symbolic of, you know, of the entire United States. But most, if not all, decisions would be based on, you know, regional governments. Mm-hmm. And I'd even go so far as to say that if the federal government is in symbolic, there's no need to have elections at that level. You just have appointees based upon. Yep, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to, so let me, Nolan, let me take that back to the guests here. So defederalizing power back into the states. I think I heard, Nolan, you were also suggesting then we wouldn't need a president. We wouldn't need a national election.
Well, no, it's white smoke, black smoke. I mean, if you regionalize the, you know, the government process by combining certain states so that, you know, the burden is more absorbed locally, the dependency of the federal government is significantly reduced. I mean, originally, okay, to my knowledge, the federal government was just supposed to, you know, tax and represent, you know, the entire United States. If they're just representing, mm-hmm, four or five, maybe six regions, mm-hmm, then there's no longer the requirement for that power. The power is now regionalized.
Professor McDaniel, what do you think?
I think it's an interesting take. I mean, we can think about some of the problems associated with the Articles of Confederation with a weak federal government. But part of the reason why we've seen the federal government grow in power is because of crises. So, mm-hmm, you can think of, you know, the Civil War, the New Deal, the Cold War, where we've seen the federal government grow in size quite a bit. And so one of the problems we have is that whenever a major crisis hits, the federal government gets more and more powerful. And as you know, any institution that gains power is not willing to get rid of that power.
Richard, I was reading about what the EU is doing on climate change. You have all these countries with different identities, and it hasn't been smooth. And there's a lot of fractiousness. There's a lot of, you know, push and pull. But do they have a model that may be more appropriate for addressing the kinds of issues that we are seeing remain unaddressed for decades in the United States? What do you think of their model?
I'm not sure I would quite say that. I mean, I don't think too many people are very satisfied with the stability or the, you know, the structure of the European Union at this point. They have a major, you know, problem with democracy as much as we do. And they're still in the process of becoming, you know, they call it an ever closer union. So I'm not sure that we should model ourselves on the European Union. I think that the answers to our constitutional problems have to sort of come from within. I mean, I pretty much agree with the caller, Nolan, I believe, about the idea of regional devolution. That's pretty much where I end up in my thinking about these things, which is that if we want to avoid a breakup of the country, into smaller nations, you know, which could potentially be kind of a violent and unpleasant scenario, we might have to envision some kind of breakdown or some kind of devolution of power to more regional levels. As to whether that would completely make superfluous national elections, I'm not sure. You know, Switzerland has a federal system in which I believe the heads of each of the states form a council at the national level. So that would be, you know, a council of, you know, 5 or 8 or 10 governors of these new regions, which would decide whatever is left to the federal level. I'm not so sure about that particular aspect of it, but I definitely think that regionalization is something that, you know, may already be happening, whether we like it or not.
Let me take a call here from Brandon in Duluth. Hi, Brandon. What are you thinking about?
Hi, Carrie. So I kind of wanted to go back a little bit towards the Constitutional Convention proposal and also kind of elaborate on what this country's foundation really was. It's a representative Republican democracy. And I think that we stray away from that with a bicameral legislature entirely. I think that the best option would be to expand upon a unicameral legislature and create a bigger house. That would eliminate the need for redistricting or like expanding states or making states smaller entirely, because the representatives representation would actually, be focused on just a unicameral House.
So this is, I'm short on time, so I'm going to take this right back to Professor McDaniel. And with this idea, Professor, that the House is closer to the people, right? More direct representative of the people. What do you think of this idea?
No, I think this is something that a lot of people have pushed for, of expanding the size of the House and creating more congressional districts. To where instead of, I think right now, we're about 700,000 people per district, to basically maybe get it down to something like 500,000. And so this would be much more successful. I think, much more representative in the long run. I think it's an interesting idea to try out, and maybe, again, instead, defang the Senate. But I also think one of the things we want to address is the two-party system, and maybe along with increasing this, also find ways to have a multi-party system. And I think with the way that Congress is set up and having a two-party system can undermine representation and undercut people's voices being able to get to the top.
Richard, I have about a minute. What would you say about that?
I think it's a great idea. You know, a parliamentary, system, I think, would be a lot better for our purposes and would enable the kind of multi-party formation that Professor McDaniel talked about. The problem, I would just, quibble with the caller, the founders were not interested in establishing a representative democracy. They really wanted the people to have as little say as possible in the affairs of the nation. You know, Washington dismissed the masses in a letter as the grazing multitude, comparing us to cattle. The problem is that we're trying to fit a democracy into what was specifically meant to be not only an undemocratic system, but an anti-democratic system. And that is why the amendment process is so difficult and why we're in such dire straits, at the moment. I think we have to liberate ourselves from the idea that we need to be, whatever we propose needs to be compatible with the founders' interests, and return to more of what we were talking about earlier, which is the idea of self-government and the right and really the responsibility to devise institutions and an entire system of government that fits our needs and not those of, slave owners and aristocrats from the 18th century.
So this was super interesting. Thanks to all the calls and the all, problem solving from listeners this morning, and our guest, just terrific. Eric McDaniel is an associate professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. And Richard Kreitner is a writer for The Nation and the author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. Weather and news coming next.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. Thanks for listening.